thank you for being a friend. Travel down the road and back again. Your heart is true, you're a pal and a confidant. If you threw a party and invited everyone you knew, you would see the biggest gift would be from me. And the card attached would say, thank you for being a friend.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beloved Journal. My name is Rob Lee, and I am the host. We continue our journey in this season talking about beautiful things, those things which bring out the best of us, the beauty in us, the beloved nature of ourselves. And today is an episode that you don't want to miss, and you're probably going to want to share with your friends and family, for which I would be so grateful if you did. Today on the podcast, we welcome famed British poet and Anglican priest, Malcolm Gait. Malcolm is an incredibly gifted practitioner of poetry, an intellectual scholar of poetry. He is a zealous evangelist of poetry. He loves poetry and in a lot of ways embodies the poetic. His work has been celebrated by His Majesty King Charles III and Archbishops of Canterbury, both recent and from eras gone by. I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I enjoyed recording it. It was like riffing with someone who was a heavyweight boxer, just going back and forth, question and answer, question and answer. It was such fun to record. It's one of my absolute favorite podcasts that we've had on Beloved Journal. But with that in mind, I'm going to stop talking and let Malcolm take center stage. Let's listen in. Malcolm, thank you so much for coming on Beloved Journal.
I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
I've been looking forward to this. I'm curious, kind of straight out of the gate, what makes a poet? What is it inside you that has made you who you are?
Oh, wow. That's a very big question to start off with. Well, I mean, I think one begins starting with, by talking more about poetry itself rather than the poet. It's a kind of romantic and post-romantic thing to concentrate it into the person. So poetry, I think, is language which is somehow elevated or transfigured. It's language which is capable of being, as it were, bigger on the inside than the outside, of bearing more than you might first think. And often the mark of that elevation of language, well, traditionally it has been until really the mid-20th century, it was marked by a musicality of diction, by rhythm, that is to say meter in poetry, by rhyme or assonance. And I continue to do that. I think I want to summon the inherent music that's there waiting to be coaxed out in the English language. But poetry, I think, is also always distinguished by metaphor, that is to say, you know, one thing becoming the embodiment or clothing for another. A particular physical thing being able to encapsulate or suggest an inward or spiritual thing. I think there's a close relationship there with within the church world with sacrament. So I think there's a quasi-sacramental element to poetry, and which can again be enhanced. So the poet is somebody who is sensitive to that mode of language and who makes themselves consciously and deliberately available to it. I think that's partly where the language of the muse comes from, but also a poet, in my view, is somebody who spends a long time honing certain skills with language. But the other thing is that poetry is a tradition. It's never a sharply separated individual thing. I think of myself as belonging to a great tradition. I consciously draw on my predecessor poet priests like George Herbert, or more recently R.S. Thomas, or John Donne, Gerard Manley Hopkins. But I was had the good fortune to study English literature at Cambridge, but I've also loved it all my life. I was very fortunate to be born into a household full of books and where poetry is often spoken and chanted. So I'm very conscious of the long tradition of English poetry going right back into Anglo-Saxon times or early English times. And I want to be and find now that I am part of that tradition. And for that reason, poetry for me is part of a long conversation. It's not an isolated, individualistic kind of ego story confessional thing. And I consciously react against the tradition in, not the tradition, but the recent innovation, by recent I mean in the last 70 or 80 years, where poetry's become highly individualized, rather like society, and you got a kind of deliberately obscure and very confessional poetry. Now, sometimes that's interesting, but sometimes it, I mean, after a while it becomes tedious because you buy another slim volume of modern poetry and it turns out to be another couple of curious adventures in the little world of me. You know, I want poetry that speaks on the public page and deals with our common story and our common experiences. Obviously, always through an individual lens, but anyway, it's a rather roundabout answer. But I'm a poet. I wanted to be a poet because I love poetry, and it's the love of poetry, the reading of it as well as writing of it, which I think makes me a poet.
I see your answer is somewhat translatable to what it means to be a priest or pastor or preacher in the time in which we live, in which this is a highly specialized yet generalized field, right?
Like, yes, absolutely. I gradually, I mean, my vocation, my sense of vocation as a poet preceded my vocation as a priest, and indeed preceded my return to Christianity as a, you know, as an adult. But I do now see them as two aspects of the same calling. I once did a retreat over several days whose purpose was to try and get help me distill into a single sentence what was the particular thing I thought I was on earth to do. And my sentence was blindingly obviously once I'd written it, but until I wrote it, I didn't have the focus. So my sentence was to use my love of language and facility for it to kindle my own and other people's imagination for Christ. And that's kind of what I do and why I do it. And that fits both my poetic and my priestly vocations, I think, pretty clearly.
Oh, for sure, and that dovetails in well, because this podcast is being recorded in Lent, and it will actually air the day before St. Patrick's Day, and you center a considerable amount of your poems within the liturgical year, which makes sense as a priest in the Church of England. I'm curious, though, what about the liturgical year compels you to ground your poems there, to talk about the liturgical year, to center us within the rhythm and rhyme of what it means to be a liturgical people?
Well, I think the liturgical year is one of the great sort of treasures of the church, really. It's a kind of slow and repeated reenactment, in a sense, liturgical, dramatic, personal, spiritual, entering into becoming the story of our salvation, because it takes you, you know, the liturgical year, as you probably know, doesn't begin at the same time as the calendrical year. It begins at the beginning of December with Advent. You get these 4 weeks of waiting for the Advent, the coming of Christ, which is seen in a triple lens. It's his coming. Yes, it's remembering the coming that we remember at Christmas. Then it's all the other ways he comes to us. And then it's looking to some kind of conclusion to history, some sort of final manifestation of the triumph of God's love and mercy and justice in the world, the righting of wrongs. And so you have 4 days, you have 4 weeks to prepare for that. And then if you think about it, you go through his birth, you go through lots of the stories of revealing in Epiphany who he was. Then you do this very, very focused thing, particularly in Holy Week, Good Friday and Easter, on the final week of his life. And then you later on, you remember his ascension and you remember the sending of the Holy Spirit. And there are times when you think about the Trinity, and interspersed with all those are these wonderful saints days where people who are nearer and closer to you at sense. And now what that does I'll tell you, one of the first things it does is it delivers the poor, long-suffering congregation from the kind of preacher who only has about five texts that they ever want to preach on with their own particular theological hobby horses. And they just go through that. It gives you a wide conspectus. If you read all the readings associated with you, it gives you a very good overview of the Bible. But the real thing is that every Christmas, every Easter, every Good Friday deepens because of all the other ones, because of all the ones before, the times when Good Friday has happened to coincide with one of your own times of acute suffering. Your Good Friday matches his Good Friday, the times when you've needed Easter to lift you up. So gradually your own journey through time and the great story of the redemption of time kind of get brought together in a creative way. Lancelot Andrews, who was one of the great sort of founders in a way of the Anglican vision, a preacher in the late 16th and early 17th century, a court preacher to both Elizabeth and James, and one of the main translators of the authorized version. In fact, he was kind of in charge of that project, really. Anyway, Andrews, very great preacher, has a wonderful sermon where he makes a very interesting analogy. He says, wouldn't it be good if you've ever had the occasion to have a thief come and rob you of something, wouldn't it be great if you could make that very same thief come back and return what he took? And obviously in the congregation saying, well, that would be good. And he says, well, look, who is the real thief here around here? Time is the thief. Time steals away every memory. Time steals away the days that you wanted. Time is continually thieving from you. But if you set a memorial day in time, then as the year circles round, time is obliged to bring it back to you. You have those meditations on one Good Friday and you think you lose them over the course. But lo and behold, time the thief becomes time the restorer and brings it back to you. So that's another reason why we do it. And these are mysteries. I mean, the great things, you know, the incarnation, the passion, the atonement, the resurrection, the ascension. They're mysteries in this sense that there's something about which the last word can never be said. They're so full, they can never be contained by any human formulation. And it's always unfortunate when, or important as it is to try and formulate some dogma, the dogma is not the mystery to which it points or which it guards. The dogma is only a set of words. The mystery always transcends it. And to be brought back towards the mystery of good. But one of the reasons why I write poetry about the liturgical year, which I'm thinking about a lot at the moment, because there's about to be a new and expanded version of that book, Sounding the Seasons. It came out, 12 years ago, and it's been through many, many reprints, which I'm very glad of. It's obviously people have found it helpful. But I've inhabited, 12 more years of that cycle since it was published, and I've written new poems, and I've decided to bring in more of the saints, and I've now written a series of sonnets about the resurrection, because I felt that I was too light on that in the first year. So a bit later we're going to bring out the second one, so then in a new expanded edition. And so I've been reflecting on it again, and I think the reason for bringing poetry to bear on the liturgical year is precisely because poetry is that mysterious multivalent way of speaking. A poem never closes down on what it's about. It opens out what it's about. If I have an idea of what I'm going to say in a poem, and I jot the idea down, and then I write the poem, and there's no more in the poem than my idea in the first place, it's not a poem. It's a note to self. It's only as the language of the poetry itself quickens and begins to tell me new things that I realize I have a live poem on hand,
Well, and to me at least, I may be a novice. I'm certainly a novice at this in comparison to you. Every poet has a poem that's like one of their greatest hits, the one that moves someone beyond measure in the terms of the receiving of the poem. To me, if I were to assign that to you, I would say your poem on the Holy Innocents speaks to me on so many levels. The last lines, but every Herod dies and comes alone to stand before the Lamb upon the throne. That gives me chills every time I hear it. I have heard also that gave His Majesty the King some movement of spirit too, as he had it read at his request at a Christmas service. As someone who has a bit of an American monarchist as I am, I'm curious what it was like to have your poem uplifted at the request of an earthly king.
Yeah, that was a pretty extraordinary experience. It was also obviously I got to know about that a little bit in advance. I had to give my formal permission and stuff like that. I had actually just finished visiting someone in a rather grim and depressing prison, and I was sitting in the kind of grotty railway station waiting for my train, feeling rather low. But of course, the poem is precisely about people in distress. So, anyway, So it was extraordinary to get this email, saying, and the king was very specific about wanting it to be mentioned in the service that he'd chosen it. And I think that's because the poem was about refugees. It was about the displaced people. It was about seeing Christ is there as well as in our churches. We think of him as safe beneath the steeple or cozy in a crib beside the font, but he is with 1 million displaced people on the long road of weariness and want. Now, of course, it's very important from our constitutional point of view that the king is above politics and is not directly political, although of course the king meets with the prime minister every week. But I felt that was perhaps as close as the king could get in an oblique way of saying, my faith and the faith of which I am the defender also moves me to at least empathize with and defend these helpless people. So I was very glad. Obviously, it was nice for me, to know. I didn't know that the king knew about my poetry at that point. I had actually, I once gave a lecture on Coleridge for the Temenos Academy, of which he's patron, and he wrote to me personally about listening to the lecture, which he'd done offline, and asked for a copy of my book. So I knew he was probably faintly aware of my existence. But that poem, I think, obviously, it gave the poem a great fillip. It had actually, I don't know how he came across it directly or indirectly, but some years earlier, the Archbishop of Canterbury quoted a chunk of that poem, not the whole of it, in an ecumenical Christmas letter that went, obviously, to the patriarchs and to the Pope and so on. So I knew that and it's very possible the King read it there, but it's part of a sequence of poems about the immediate days after Christmas. I mean, one of the extraordinary things is that it was written for the very difficult church marking year of the Massacre of the Innocents. I mean, there's a very dark backdrop to Christmas. I mean, not unlike some of the backdrop that we're looking at right now. There's violence in the Middle East, there's movements of people, there's a threat of killing children for political convenience, I mean, in the end. And somebody wanting to hang on to power. And the Holy Family is caught up in that. And a long Christian reflection, many centuries of Christian reflection, have said this wasn't like bad timing for the incarnation, but precisely the point that he chose to expose himself to, from the beginning until in the end on the cross when he's tortured to death in a kind of what is effectively an extrajudicial killing or a fake trial, and that God sees the havoc of the world, which is caused by our freedom, and he wants to preserve our freedom because you can't love if you're not free. But he, as it were, God says, look, I'm willing to take my own medicine here. I'm willing to suffer with you. I think it's worth it. And the resurrection is a way of saying, even when the worst of humanity has done its worst to you, that's not the end of your story. It wasn't the end of Christ's story, and it's not going to be the end of either of our stories. There is an answer to all of these things, which is Easter Day.
One of the things that I've been thinking about, Malcolm, I had the privilege in July of 2021 to adopt two amazing, precocious, kind, caring girls into our family. My wife and I had that privilege. And I wonder, you spoke about earlier how you were introduced to poetry as a child. You had books around, and we try to do that for our children too. How best do you introduce a child to the beauty and mystery and wonder of a poem? Or a poetry, a genre that has moved you in such a way that you yourself feel moved to share it.
Well, I think I'd start with the encouraging reflection that children are naturally poets. I mean, Coleridge defined a poet as a person who brings the vision of the child into the powers of the adult. I mean, if you actually look at how children acquire language and you listen to their first cooings and imitations of their mother and the first, they're entirely rhythmic and rhyming. We may not be able to understand them. They may not be English yet, but they're already poetry. And some of the first things that children know and love are nursery rhymes, which most of which are, in fact, really good poetry. And I think prose is a later and weaker sort of sophistication and, adulteration of a primal poetic discourse. So children naturally love poetry. They like old-fashioned poetry. They like poetry that rhymes and has rhythm. And, in America, you have the Dr. Seuss books, and here we have sort of, Robert Louis Stevenson's, A Child's Garden of verses with, for example, the one about the railway carriage, when railway carriages were a very new and exciting thing, and he wrote, faster than fairies, faster than witches, bridges and houses, hedges and ditches, charging along like troops in a battle, all through the meadows, the horses and cattle, about looking out from a railway train. So I think if you enjoy poetry, your children will see that it's enjoyable. My mother was full of poetry. I think the poetry comes down from my mother's side. She recited poetry all the time, but naturally, as part of her ordinary conversation. She didn't sit me down in a corner and say, now this is poetry, it's good for you, and you must have 10 minutes of it before you're allowed to go out and play. No, nothing of that kind ever happened. It was much more that we'd be, my mother and I would be standing and looking at a sunset. And she would just naturally say, out beyond the sunset, could I but find the way, is a sleepy blue laguna that widens to a bay. And there's the blessed city, or so the sailors say, the golden city of St. Mary. And I would have this image in my mind that there was something beyond the sun, as it were, behind the sunset. It's a wonderful idea. It's a tremendously poetic idea. Or, when we were on a boat or a ship ourselves, she'd say, the fair breeze blew, the white foam flew, the furrow followed free. We were the first that ever burst into that silent sea. Now, she didn't say, this is an epic, a great poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge called The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. She just quoted a bit of it. And I asked for more. Where did that come from? Of course, she knew it. So, years later, having first heard that poem in all my almost pre-literate years, I must have been 4 or 5 when she started reciting that to me. Years later, when my mother was 97, I was able to put into her hand the first copy of a book I wrote about that poem and about Coleridge, which I dedicated to her. In fact, I sent it up to her by post. She was living up in Scotland. And by the time, a month or two later, I arrived to see her, she'd read the whole thing and was ready to talk to me about all kinds of different parts of it. And then to remind me of a story I didn't knew, that once when we were in the Southern Ocean, we were in the south of Africa, sailing around the Horn and back to England. An albatross had, in fact, come and flown and settled on the boat, and she'd pointed it out to me. So, I think if it's naturally part of that thing, nursery rhymes is the place to start. But I don't think my grandfather on my mother's side, was an educationalist, a teacher, eventually an inspector of schools for the Highlands and Islands. And he believed strongly that there should be no graded readers. There should be no limitation of vocabulary or even subject, that children should be exposed to the best literature from the earliest age. And it didn't matter a jot whether they understood it. They would get something and it would be good. So he read Milton and Shakespeare in their cradles to my mother and my uncle. And my mother and father did the same for me. They saw no reason not to do that. So even much later, when I came upon quite sophisticated poems, there was always a faint echo somewhere from my childhood.
I love that. So for podcasts are not obviously visual mediums, but you've been smoking a pipe and are known to be quite the expert on pipes, pipe tobacco and smoking a pipe. I actually worked at a cigar store in high school, and I was always found in the pipe section of that store. I found it much more agreeable than the cigars. They kind of harken back to a different time, a slower time, a more pastoral time. Has pipe smoking taught you anything you didn't know about yourself or the world?
Oh, no, that's a good... Yeah, well, I mean, it's certainly done a singularly important thing for me, more and more important as the world speeds up. And that is, of course, to slow me down. It's quiet, it's meditative. You've got to do so much to, clean the pipe, and then, you've got to pack the tobacco right, and it takes more than one light. And if you think that some people used to smoke cigarettes mainly to have something to do with their hands, pipes give you that in spades. And of course, you don't inhale pipe smoke, so it's a question just of tasting it. So it's not so bad for you. Although, I'm just wrestling with a ridiculous thing at the moment. So when the lockdown came, I was so frustrated that I couldn't be with my students. And as a chaplain in my study, my chaplaincy was very much one of presence. Just anybody could come and call on me and we'd have a chat. And as like as not, I'd pull a volume off the shelves and read them something that might be enlightening or helpful. And I could no longer do that. So I taught myself YouTube one morning and how to post a video. And my wife kindly held the iPhone and knocked on the door as my proxy visitor. And I started this thing called a spell in the library. And as often as not, when somebody comes in, I'd be smoking a pipe. But I've now discovered that YouTube object to the ones where the pipe is prominent, and they say, oh, you know, we can only limit the advertising on it or whatever. It's, you know, it's noxious substances or it's dangerous behavior or something. And it's, you know, now coming a cropper against, you know, community things, which is really ironic because, I mean, I have many thousands of subscribers, and the most common, frequent comment on my spell in the library is, this is really wholesome. This is really safe. I love to come to this with my family, you know, like I'm doing the most community-minded thing I could possibly do. And now I find I'm falling foul of community rules because I'm smoking my pipe quietly in a corner. I mean, it seems extraordinary. It's categorized in the same category as sort of like, you know, dangerous, you know, YouTube dare crazes or something. Anyway, I must try and sort this out. Sorry, that's neither here nor there. Perhaps you don't need to. But perhaps I'll give you an idea of really what I think pipe smoking is about, if you don't mind, by reading your poem about blowing smoke rings from my pipe. Is there space for a poem? It probably says more than I can in prose.
Please do.
So this is it's from my collection, Parable and Paradox. It's in the old-fashioned ballad form. All the long day's weariness is done. I'm free at last to do just as I will. Take out my pipe, admire the setting sun, practice the art of simply sitting still. Thank God I have this briar bowl to fill. I leave the world with all its hopeless hype, its pressures, and its ever-ringing tale, and let it go in smoke rings from my pipe. The hustle and the bustle, these I shun, the tasks that trouble and the cares that kill, the false idea that there's a race to run, the pushing of that weary stone uphill, the wretched iPhones, all insistent trill, whingers and whiners, each with their own gripe. I pack them in tobacco leaves until they're blown away in smoke rings from my pipe. And then, at last, my real work is begun. My chance to chant, to exercise the skill of summoning the muses, one by one, to meet me in their temple, touch my quill. I have a pen, but quills are better still. And when the soul is full, the time is ripe, kindle the fire of poetry that will breathe and expand like smoke rings from my pipe. Prince, I have done with grinding at the mill. These petty, pelting tyrants aren't my type. So lift me up and set me on a hill, a free man blowing smoke rings from his pipe.
Stunning, stunning, truly stunning.
Thank you. That is quite a light-hearted poem in its own way, but I think there's a lot to be said for anything that is a quiet or meditative practice, just as there's a lot to be said for books over against other media occasionally, just to rest your eyes from the brightness of the screen, if nothing else. C.S. Lewis had an interesting principle. He said you should read two old books for every new book that you read. Because he said, we're always dominated by the particular biases and prejudices of our age, the spirit of our age, whatever it is. And it's not the earlier ages, it's not that the Middle Ages or the Renaissance or you know, the time of the Caroline Divines or the Romantics. It's not that they didn't have a spirit. They did have a spirit of the age. They had their own prejudices too, but they were different from ours. So if we want to count, if we want not to be imprisoned by, you know, the shallowness of a merely contemporary zeitgeist, then it is really important to read old books, which can be anything from, you know, translations of Plato, obviously the scriptures, you know, just the poetry of different ages. And we're fortunate that pretty much from Chaucer onwards, you know, English poetry is readable. There's the odd word you might have difficulty with, but you can, you know, that's where you can use the web to just check out the glossary, you know. But I think there's no substitute for an actual book with the smell of an old book and the printed pages and the softness of the lighting in your study or wherever it is you can sit and, you know, read. I think that's a genuinely recreative and indeed rejuvenating practice.
It's almost like you're reading my questions. I've noticed, of course, in watching you and listening to you and reading your work, that you have a deep love for Tolkien's works.
Yes, absolutely.
I have not read them yet, and that is one of my goals this year is to start that journey. I've always been more concerned with Star Trek. I am a Star Trek fan far more than I was ever was of Middle Earth. Still,
Well,
I
I
sent.
watched Star Trek as a teenager and as a kid. We lived in Canada, so that first Star Trek series was full of good things.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. It is poetry too to me in some ways when I watch some episodes and I see what they were working through, especially in the first series in the 1960s. They're working through things in real time that is really interesting. And I
Well,
sense.
I watched those as they came out,
Yeah.
and it was or certainly in the same sort of era. And it was amazing the way they did the thing that Shakespeare tells in Hamlet. Hamlet tells the players that they should do, which is to hold, as it were, a mirror up to nature. You
Right,
see
right.
the thing you've seen in one way, just in a new frame, and you suddenly see it whole or for what it is.
Well, and that's the thing. I sense a fellow geek in you, and I mean that in the most generous and compassionate and kind way. What is it that compels you about these fandoms, this especially Tolkien? What is it that compels
Well,
you about these
Tolkien is
things to be a
amazing. I
fan?
mean, you won't be surprised to hear that my first foray into the world of pipe smoking was directly inspired by The Hobbit, and which begins with Bilbo smoking a very long pipe outside his front door as an image of sort of contentment. And then, of course, it goes throughout. I mean, when Bilbo only finds the ring because he's looking for his pipe, which he thought might have broken as he fell. And of course, the last three words of The Hobbit are the tobacco jar. He's handing Gandalf the tobacco jar. So that's kind of woven through. And that's where the pipes. But no, why Tolkien? Well, I mean, Tolkien, as you know, was a professor of Anglo-Saxon, of early English, and he knew the roots of language, the roots of all the languages that made up English, the Celtic and the English and the Latin and the Norman. But he was very interested in also Finnish and Old High German. And he realized that languages and stories go together, that stories explain language, and then language is the way of making story. And I think he felt that we had somehow lost, perhaps after the Norman invasion, the English people had lost some of their deepest stories. I mean, we have a few survivals. We have Beowulf and the Battle of Maldon. And he said at one point, he's got an ambition to create a new legendarium for his own people, as it were. In fact, he created a legendarium for the world, to tell stories at such a deep level that they body forth, in Shakespeare's phrase, they embody, they give us means of thinking about all kinds of other things which might otherwise escape us, or which we wouldn't see in quite the same way. Now, this is not to say that they're frigid allegory. An allegory is where you've thought of something you want to say and you just translate it from term A into term B. And then when it's done, you translate it back and term A pops out exactly the same unaltered. That's allegory. And Tolkien said, I cordially dislike allegory and, flee it in all its forms. But the word that he and Lewis were made up for what they were trying to do and what they thought their predecessor, George MacDonald, was to write in a mytho-poetic way. So mythos means story, poetic means making or poetry. So it's poetic myth-making. And I mean, an obvious example is once we are very apropos with Oppenheimer getting all the Oscars and things, a lot of people assumed that the ring story was an allegory of nuclear weapons, and that these were ultimately so destructive that we couldn't use them and we can't use the enemy's weapon against him. And they thought it was an argument about that. All those aspects of the story had been thought of long before nuclear weapons were a possibility. But he was talking deeply, looking deeply through story at the nature of power, at the way power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, as Acton had said the century before. That was Lord Acton said that was a lesson of history. All power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it was a prophetic book, not in the sense that it anticipated individual issues like that, but that it gave us the epic for our times we need. And I would sum it up like this: I mean, obviously, Lewis, I mean, Tolkien knew every single, epic myth that there was, and in most of the treasure quests, which is a genre you get in every culture, the quest is to acquire something. Something has been stolen or hidden, and you have to get it back, or there's a ring with powers, or there's a. Jason and the Argonauts would be a classic example of it, go and find the Golden Fleece. Almost every existing epic, I think, that the humans had produced up to that point was an epic of acquisition. What Tolkien did brilliantly and just in time was to write an epic of letting go, an epic of renunciation, just before the worst aspects of consumerism hit us. I'm going to let go. I shall diminish and go into the West. I'm going to accept that my life is limited. I'm not going to endlessly extend it, by turning my body into a sort of soup full of other people's organs. I mean, I am going to say, I have a beginning, a middle, and end, like a good poem, and I shall make the best. I shall try and end as well as I began, which is the way a poem should do. I'm going to accept my limitations. And I'm not going to be possessed by my possessions. And insofar as my possessions begin to possess me, I'm going to endeavor to let them go. Now, that's exactly what Western individualistic consumer culture needs. And then, of course, it's all about a fellowship. So it's a prophecy against extreme individualism. And then if you think about the resurgence, I mean, the alarming and terrible resurgence of racism of various sorts, this fellowship consists not just of different races, but if you like, of different species, and ones who've been opposed to each other, the dwarves and the elves, an old rivalry has to be mended. There has to be a gathering together. And the thing you notice about the fellowship is that the various people in it, men and elves and dwarves and hobbits, don't become less like themselves. Their unique quiddity is not in any way, diminished by joining a fellowship. They become more themselves. Now, there's a huge amount of really awful xenophobic rhetoric out there, which suggests that if we have different races or cultures in our society, one race or another, and they usually try and claim that it's the quote-unquote white one, is somehow threatened or diminished or losing its identity. So Tolkien, who, as it happens, probably knows more about the deepest identity of Englishness than anybody in the world, writes a story in which people with really quite different identities and cultures need to work together and become more themselves by doing so. And again, you couldn't ask for something more needed now. And I delight in the fact that his works are so popular.
You've sold me on it. I mean, it's been a goal to read this work. And of course, it will take time.
They are just also incredibly enchanting. They're just very well written. But you must surrender yourself to them. You must put aside, don't try and do any of the kind of allegorizing that I've just done. That's for later. Just allow the story itself to carry you forward. Surrender yourself to the story. And the real hero of the story, in a way, is language itself. That's why, good as I think that, Jackson's first attempts, I think the first three films were quite good. The first was the best. The Hobbit was an abomination. But in a way, he was setting himself an impossible task, because the hero of those stories is language itself. And that's the one thing you miss in the movie.
And sometimes that's missed when you translate from cinema. There is stuff that we miss from Oppenheimer, from Prometheus, and I mean, you said, yeah, and all everything. So, you miss American Prometheus. You miss these things. And so I want to ask you one last question. I could talk to you all day. You're so fascinating, so gifted, so thoughtful. But on this podcast each season, my team and I come up with a question to ask everyone who comes on our show for that series of episodes. So here is the question for this season. I hope you might give it a shot. What is the most beautiful thing you've ever seen or witnessed in your life?
Wow. Oh, my goodness. What is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen or witnessed in my whole life? I have seen and witnessed many beautiful things. Okay. I'll tell you it's a very brief story. There was when I was taking services in a church in Cambridge, there was a lady who used to come and just sit at the back and slip away again. And I felt something was happening. She was something was being given to her by this liturgy. And but she never spoke a word. And then we were coming up into Holy Week, as we're coming to it now. And the story of the anointing at Bethany happened to be the gospel, where if you remember the details, Jesus withdraws for a moment of quietness and intimacy with his closest friends. And Mary, he's got Mary and Martha and Lazarus there, but he's also got the disciples. And Mary, who is always sitting at Jesus' feet, you know, she knows what's coming. She knows he's going to give everything. And she takes the precious alabaster jar of ointment and she breaks it so it can never be used again. She breaks it open and laves his feet with it. And the whole room is filled with the odor, says John. And Judas, who happens to be there, says, what a waste. This could have been sold for 300 denarii and it could have been given to the poor. And John can't help adding editorially, well, this is because he kept the bag and, you know, he was probably... Jeremy Taylor, the great 17th century Anglican, commenting on this passage, said that 300 denarii, if you translated the denarii up from copper to pieces of silver, is the 30 pieces of silver that he himself receives for the price of Jesus's head. But he says, what a waste. And Jesus's rebuke, I'm going to get to the beautiful thing that I witnessed in a minute. Jesus's rebuke to Judas is brilliant. He says, no. He says, the poor you will always have with you. You won't always have me with you. And then he says this. It's the only time in the Gospels that Jesus uses the word beautiful. He says, she has done a beautiful thing. And wherever the gospel is preached, she will be remembered. So I preached about this and I preached about the extravagance of love. And I pointed out that Judas perfectly fulfilled Oscar Wilde's definition of a cynic. That a cynic is a person who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. He knows the price of the costly perfume, but he's no idea of the value of Jesus or what Jesus is going to do, whereas Mary has, you know. It was a fairly straightforward sermon, but I could see this woman. Anyway, this woman, and I said, the point about it is not, was it good or what was the practical effect? The point is, was it extravagant love poured out? That extravagant love is always beautiful, something like that. So this woman came up to me afterwards and she was in tears. And she explained to me that she had a daughter who was infected, who was like quadruply disabled and in a wheelchair and couldn't speak. And she, the mother, had been looking after this daughter all her life and knowing the daughter would eventually die, but giving it, you know, washing and bathing and cleansing her. And somebody, you know, supposedly to help her had said, you're wasting your life. They used the same word as Judas. What a waste. And she'd been really upset by that because she knew it wasn't a waste, but she couldn't articulate why it wasn't a waste. And because I made a contrast between the word waste that Judas used in this passage and the extravagant love, this woman had suddenly, in the middle of my sermon, had the revelation that what she was doing for her daughter was, in fact, breaking open the jar, and that all her care for her daughter was the costly ointment. And that she was doing it for Jesus as well. And she was in tears, but she'd, I mean, I didn't, that was not in my mind when I was preaching, but the Lord, the Spirit took that. And I was able to feel that I witnessed for a moment this woman hearing Jesus, in a sense, saying to her that she was doing a beautiful thing. Later on, I took this woman's funeral. I mean, she was an amazing woman, but she taught me something. But I think you can see those acts of love. I think, unnoticed, unregarded, unreflected, you know, unrewarded caring done for the sake of care itself always has about it a quality of beauty. And that's why I resist, you know, to the utmost, all the utility. I mean, essentially, you know, Judas is a utilitarian. All these people who, you know, practically bringing back eugenics and saying, why do we have, you know, disabled people and people who have a go at families are bringing up Down syndrome kids. I know lots of Down syndrome kids. They're fantastic. And because I believe in the infinite worth and value of every human person, whatever their disabilities, they're made in the image of God. I find a particular beauty and holiness to be present wherever I'm in the presence, both of these people and the people who care for them.
It is a testament, too, to the fact that the sermons we preach sometimes have value beyond that which we had thought. That was probably a normal sermon for you on a normal Holy Week.
Yeah, yes, it wasn't. That wasn't the first time I preached on that passage. But you never know who's listening or what effect it's going to be. That's why you pray. I mean, I prayed before that sermon, the same thing I say before every sermon, which is, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be now and always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. And you kind of say it because that's what you say, and you kind of mean it, but how deeply... The Lord, who was this woman's strength and redeemer, you know, gave her a meditation that blessed her life, you know.
It is that's striking. That's striking. Malcolm Guide, thank you so much for coming on Beloved Journal.
My pleasure.
Beloved Journal is a podcast on a mission. Check out our other episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Today's podcast was hosted by the Reverend Rob Lee. Find him on Twitter at RobLee4 or on Instagram at RevRobLee. You can find our social media on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter by searching for Beloved Journal and finding our logo. Beloved Journal's theme music is a cover of the Golden Girls theme song done by MIPSA. Seriously, they're the best band in the world. This podcast was the dream of Stephanie Lee and was produced by Maggie the Golden Doodle and Frank the Poodle. Go show the world that it's worth fighting for. And as always, thanks for listening.